You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
There are certain movies that you watch as a child that never leave you. For me, that movie is On the Beach, starring the glamorous Ava Gardner, Fred Astaire, and the incredibly handsome Gregory Peck. It takes place in Australia, where I'm from.
Flash! Motion picture history is made as Stanley Kramer's production of On the Beach opens all over the world in unprecedented six-continent premieres.
I can remember going to see the film as a teenager, and the whole thing just really got to me. It's a movie about nuclear weapons, meaning the end of the world.
And our scientists disagree as to when radiation will reach Australia. The atomic war has ended. But the Prime Minister reports no proof of survival of human life anywhere except here.
In the movie, a U.S. submarine surfaces in Australia, and the American crew learns about the apocalypse that took place while they were submerged. Most of the world is destroyed, and radiation is slowly blowing towards Melbourne. Yet somehow life keeps going. Sunbathing on the beach and drinking to excess at fancy cocktail parties, until the truth inevitably breaks through.
The background level of radiation in this very room is 9 times what it was a year ago. Don't you know that?
And it's always, always Julian, a drunk scientist played by Fred Astaire, who seems to be the guy saying the thing that everybody is trying to ignore.
We're all doomed, you know. The whole silly, drunken, pathetic lot of us. Doomed by the air we're about to breathe. We haven't got a chance!
On the Beach came out in 1959, but the themes it touched on are very much relevant today, especially as China quietly builds up its nuclear arsenal and relations with the US continue to strain. I'm Jane Perlez, and this is Face Off, a series about the tensions in the US-China relationship. On this episode, we'll speak with an expert on China's nuclear history, about how we got to this point and how we might avoid the dystopian future that plays out in On the Beach. Here's the background you need to know. China first became a nuclear power in 1964 when Mao exploded a bomb over the western region of Xinjiang. Mao had some strange ideas about nuclear weapons. He actually suggested to the Soviet leader Khrushchev that it would be okay if a nuclear bomb hit China and wiped out several hundred million people. He said the surviving women could just produce more babies. He actually said that. For many years after that, the Chinese nuclear program was relatively low profile. That is, until recently, when Xi Jinping began to ramp things up.
We do have some breaking news. There are satellite images, and what they appear to show is rapid construction at several suspected silo fields in China that could eventually launch nuclear weapons.
In recent years, satellite images have revealed 3 new missile silo fields being built in sites across China, including the far western region of Xinjiang, the same region where Mao tested that first nuclear bomb.
So according to open source research, China is building 3 large sites for missile silos, and those silos appear large enough to accommodate intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs. So those missiles can range the homeland of the United States from China.
My guest today is nuclear expert Tong Zhao.
A few years ago, the official language in China was China will maintain a lean and effective nuclear force. There was no emphasis on a big nuclear arsenal. The official language became China will build a powerful, strategic deterrent capability. So from lean to powerful, that's a very important change, even in official narrative.
What this means is that China and Russia, longtime nuclear powers, could align with each other against the US. In addition to those three new missile silo fields, China now has roughly 500 nuclear warheads, and they're building fast to catch up to the US. My guest, Tong Zhao, is a senior fellow with the Nuclear Policy Program in Carnegie, China. He recently relocated to Washington from Beijing. He has, to my mind, the closest peek into the Chinese perspective as to why Xi Jinping has decided to build up China's nuclear arsenal. I began my conversation with Zhao asking him, why are they doing this now?
I think in some sense, Xi Jinping inherits the previous thinking of China's former paramount leaders. And paramount leaders like Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, they have all said things like, China needs to have a nuclear capability that is commensurate with China's international status. I think Xi inherits that thinking, but for him, he probably thinks that today China's international status is fundamentally different than before because China is so close to not only catch up, but potentially exceeds the United States as the number one power in the world. And he thinks and he worries that that potential power transition is going to fundamentally change China-US relationship. And that might drive the United States to adopt a much more hostile policy towards China. And therefore, China needs to demonstrate stronger strategic capability to deal with that possibility.
You mean he wants to make China so powerful in the nuclear realm that the United States will think twice before hitting China with nuclear weapons?
Yes, but not only to deter U.S. using nuclear weapons first against China. I think he anticipated that as long as China continues to close the power gap, the U.S. will adopt more hostile policy across the board towards China, including more military threats, but also greater political pressure against China, greater efforts to destabilize China's internal stability, undermining the Chinese leading party, causing internal chaos. And somehow he seems to believe that a stronger strategic military capability, including nuclear weapons, would moderate the overall American approach towards China.
What do you think of that thinking?
Yes, I can see why he thinks that a greater nuclear capability might make the U.S. think twice before initiating any military conflict with China, including at the conventional military level. But whether a greater nuclear arsenal could dissuade the United States from attacking China's human rights records, from attacking China's political system and the ruling party, you know, that's harder to tell. But the thing is, when Xi Jinping has been so successful in concentrating power and building a highly centralized decision-making system, his intuition, his logic can easily become policy without anyone willing and daring to raise questions and to ask for a thorough examination of that logic.
I want to say, as a civilian to all of this, it does seem like a very precarious time. Many of the nuclear treaties from the Cold War have been abandoned or they've expired. It's true that China was never part of these treaties, but now we're at a crossroads where China and Russia are together and they're expanding nuclear capabilities with no treaties in sight at all. Do you think China would ever join an arms control treaty?
There is very little political will to do so. There appears to be a strong political mandate from the senior leadership, Mr. Xi himself, for China to strengthen its nuclear capability as soon as possible. You know, China used to maintain a very modest and recessed nuclear posture with nuclear weapons placed on very low alert levels during peacetime. But now the Rocket Force is putting a portion of its missile units under combat-ready status, even in peacetime. And China is interested in developing a launch-on-warning capability, meaning that China will rely on early warning for the leadership to decide in a few minutes' time whether China should immediately retaliate before the enemy strike actually take place over Chinese territory.
So this combat status alert is something very new, and it sounds very alarming.
Yes, it sounds very different from China's traditional posture. You know, traditionally, China reportedly keep its nuclear warheads separate from its delivery vehicles like missiles, and even stored warheads and missiles at different locations. So China was okay with a delayed nuclear retaliation. You know, China could wait for hours or days or even weeks before deciding to retaliate. But now the rocket force is heavily emphasizing the capability of rapid launch and rapid response. And also China today is already conducting patrols by its nuclear strategic ballistic missile submarines. And that in theory would mean the Chinese nuclear submarines would carry missiles and warheads during those patrols. But we don't know at the practical level how that is being conducted.
So studying and talking and knowing so much about such a gloomy subject and end of the world subject, does it affect you personally? How do you feel about it?
I do feel an increasing obligation to do my job well because the stakes are really high. I'm deeply worried about the trajectory of things. I think the chance of a military conflict between the two major powers in the Asia-Pacific region are increasing, and therefore the risk of nuclear escalation is also growing. So working here in Washington, I'm able to observe with my own eyes American policy debates and discussion, and I am able to see the potential vulnerabilities in American internal thinking. For example, they don't fully appreciate the Chinese sense of insecurity in driving its nuclear build-up program. They didn't fully appreciate that it's the incoherent decision-making system in China that has marginalized input from the Chinese experts that led to these decisions, including nuclear build-up. And as a result, many American strategists, they are so focused on the military rationale behind the build-up, they tend to think China is now trying to fundamentally change the way it uses nuclear weapons. China perhaps wants to conduct nuclear first strike on the United States. I think those are misunderstandings of Chinese own thinking. So I hope I can better explain, based on my personal observation, the Chinese thinking and better inform and hopefully enrich the policy discussion here so that the U.S. wouldn't rush into bad decisions that could turn out to be counterproductive to not only American security interests, but also for the purpose of maintaining peace and stability. I don't think China's current nuclear policy is driven by a first-use thinking. It is more driven by a growing sense of insecurity, a growing perception of existential threat. And one problem, I think, with the policy community here is the nuclear policy community is a separate community from the China study communities. So the nuclear policy experts here don't usually have deep understanding of China's internal political environment, China's internal decision-making environment. So they tend to dismiss those internal drivers of China's nuclear policy and fix it only on the military rationale of the policy change China has demonstrated.
So I guess just one final thing. Since Putin invaded Ukraine, there's been a lot of discussion about Russia potentially using nuclear weapons in Ukraine. But you rarely hear or see such worries about Xi Jinping potentially using nuclear weapons in a war over Taiwan. And from what you say, that we should be as worried about that as we are about Putin using nuclear weapons in Ukraine?
I think the primary Chinese goal over Taiwan Strait is to deter the U.S. from using nuclear weapons or threatening the use of nuclear weapons, because China is confident about its conventional capability at the regional level. So China worries the U.S. might develop growing interest in nuclear escalation because the U.S. is losing its conventional superiority. I wouldn't rule out that in the extreme scenario when China faced a very ugly conventional defeat over Taiwan, China might consider using nuclear threats to achieve its security objectives. But that's not the primary Chinese concern today.
Well, if I was in your shoes, I would be having many, many sleepless nights.
You know, the world is entering an increasingly dangerous era. There are so many terrible things going on in Ukraine, in the Middle East. So, you know, I'm losing sleep over the risk of nuclear war, but also more broadly. And I'm, in fact, more worried about the underlying trend that is developing, which is the growing information and perception gaps at the societal level between the Chinese society and the Western society. And, you know, we see the Russian people are still relatively sympathetic to Putin's decision to go to war in Ukraine. And that's one of the important reasons that Putin has been able to maintain this war campaign. Similarly, I think the very big and growing information and perception gap between the Chinese society and the Western society, that's the most dangerous factor that makes a military conflict more likely to happen. The simple fact that the Chinese have been absorbing different information systematically for such a long time than their Western counterparts. So today, the Chinese population have developed divergent views on a wide range of basic factual issues. And that greatly reinforced the Chinese belief that the U.S. is aiming to undermine China's core interests. The U.S. is driven by hegemonic intention, and the U.S. is evil. So I think it's that type of deeply embedded conviction that makes people feel that we might need to consider nuclear weapons use.
It sounds as though we've got a lot of work to do. I hope you don't have too many nightmares at night.
Well, I do my best.
Thanks, Tong.
Thank you.
Tong Zhao is a senior fellow with the Nuclear Policy Program and Carnegie China. Up next, China historian Rana Mitter. We break down what Zhao did and did not say.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. Rana Mitter is here to discuss a bit of my conversation with Tong Zhao. One of the most interesting things I think Zhao said was that Xi Jinping seems to think that increasing China's nuclear arsenal will moderate U.S. posture towards China. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but what do you think?
Well, I was fascinated by what Tong Zhao had to say, Jane. First of all, putting the nuclear issue right in the center of the way that we think about China's relations with the Western world. Of course, we've all known that China has nuclear capacity, but putting that right at the center of the issue is a pretty sobering piece of new information, I think. But what are the scenarios coming up in the plausible near future where that kind of nuclear escalation or even the kind of nuclear threat could be useful? Would it work in terms of getting the Chinese to change their policy on Taiwan? All in all, seeing where that new capacity to deploy more powerful, more extensive nuclear weapons really helps China out in the scenarios that actually sit before it, that's not so clear to me. Do you see those scenarios?
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with you. The scenarios may not quite work out, but I do see Xi Jinping wanting many more nuclear weapons as part of his campaign to make China number one or equal to the United States. When he was in San Francisco with President Biden, he went out of his way to say that planet Earth had plenty of room for the two of us, which is a variation of what he has said in more general terms in past years. But this was much more specific. And I think that having a much bigger nuclear arsenal is as much a prestige project as much as a tactical one. I think we should also consider, what about artificial intelligence and nuclear weapons? There are very thoughtful people who think that this is number one issue and that we should be really working hard to get China to agree at the very least, or to agree to a treaty at the most, on banning artificial intelligence being in control of nuclear weapons and keeping the nukes in the hands of humans. How likely do you think it is that Xi Jinping would go along with that?
I think there's probably some leeway for it, Jane, although it will be a hard sell. Let's think back to just late 2023, when Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, called a global AI summit. And I remember there was a huge debate in the UK, and actually beyond that, about whether China should be invited or not to that conference. Now, in the end, they were. And in the end, they did send representatives. They came. And that, I think, was a sign that actually at least the initial conversations might well be ones that China's willing to take part in. Now, I think we can't be naive about this. There's an extent to which clearly it's useful to China to be in those global conversations, because by doing that, it learns more about what's going on. In that context, I think that it is the case that China would be interested in being involved in some kind of international norm. The reason that I think that it's more likely than in some other cases is that I still think that it's relatively unlikely that you would get a scenario in which it's useful for China to be able to deploy nuclear weapons, as opposed to your idea, which I think adds a lot to it, that having a larger nuclear arsenal is essentially a prestige achievement for the Chinese government. And in that context, essentially signing a treaty which binds you on a particular way of using weapons that you may not actually find is central to your own aspirations anyway, might be an easier sell than, for instance, restraint on some of the issues around, you know, territorial and maritime claims in East Asia, where China, you know, backs down not an inch as far as we can see.
We're talking about Xi Jinping and his fascination and dedication to making China a first-rate nuclear power competitive with the United States. And we know he's a strong man, but he did something absolutely extraordinary, I thought. He fired the top commanders of his rocket force. That's a military group responsible for expanding the arsenal. Why did he fire these people? It seems a sort of extraordinary lack of confidence in the very part of the military that he is depending on so much.
One of the most frustrating things about trying to interpret elite Chinese politics at the very highest levels is that apart from the people who are very closely involved, it is kind of a black box. And even now, I've struggled to find anyone who can give me a really clear explanation of why. Word that has been swirling around suggests a variety of factors, including the idea that the People's Liberation Army as a whole is still much more subject to people being able to skim off, backhanders corruptly in a way that enables them to fill their own pocket. Don't forget that Xi Jinping has many ways of defining himself, but Mr. Anti-Corruption is definitely one of those.
And it's not only anti-corruption, Rana. Anti-corruption equals political stronghold, equals political having everybody in abeyance to you, right?
Yeah, anti-corruption can be used also as a very powerful tool to say, if you don't do what I tell you, then essentially I'm going to declare that you are corrupt. So it can be very much a circle in that sense. But there's still a wide sense, at least in some parts of Chinese public opinion, that when an anti-corruption argument is used for people being fired, it tends to find a resonance. In this particular case, I think it's worth saying that there's probably at least two factors in play, although it's hard to know how important each one is. One is Xi's absolute desire to make sure that all of the silos of Chinese politics are under his control. In the PLA, of course, it was one of the first places that he started to purge. The second issue, of course, is as strategy is changing, and, you know, we've had this podcast talking about the change in the nuclear stance that China's taking, there are also wider questions of how and where the next generation of the PLA is going to develop. We've talked about this rocket force where these senior figures have been fired. The PLA Navy has also been expanded. The ground force is, in a sense, perhaps a slightly more the kind of unloved part of that. So we could also see that maybe strategic changes might, just might, be part of this abrupt change in personnel.
Rana, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Jane.
Thank you so much for listening to Face Off. Be sure to listen next week. You're in for a treat. I'll be speaking with world-renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma about the power of music over politics, and his playing for President John F. Kennedy as a 7-year-old, but being far more impressed by Danny Kaye.
Because Danny Kaye was conducting the National Symphony and playing jokes with them, making them do all kinds of things, and I thought, my, this was the guy that I want to emulate when I grow up.
This project is made possible by the generous support of the Carnegie Corporation. Face Off is produced and reported by me, Jane Perlez. Special guest, Rana Mitter. Executive producer, Mia Lobel. Senior producer, Nina Pozuki. Sound design and mixing by John Myers and Alex Lewis of Row Home Productions. Original score by Alex Lewis. Show art by Good Tape Studio. Research by Luz Ding. Special thanks to Maggie Taylor. Special thanks also to the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School for their support.
Row Home Productions.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.